This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm Gian Gomeshi, inviting you to enter the world of arts, cultural affairs, and entertainment with Q's video podcast. Feature interviews with the people and personalities shaping, captivating, and challenging culture. Delivered to your mobile device 3 times a week, visit cbc.ca/Q to subscribe to the Q video podcast and watch what we're doing.
Welcome to the final podcast of CBC Radio's Dispatches for June 21st, 2012. I'm Rick McInnes-Ray. This week, we're saying goodbye. It's our last program, but we're going out with boats, baboons, and a bang. We'll touch on some of the stories we brought you over the years, some of the places we've been, and some of the strange and sublime people we put into your radio. Along the way, we'll hear some of the moments that stopped us in our tracks and hear some untold stories from our correspondents. We saved the best for last. This is Dispatches. Welcome to the program. And after 12 seasons, the last, following the latest round of budget cuts here at the CBC. Over the years, we've been striving to bring you the world. And in the words of poet Seamus Heaney, from the frontier of writing. But in the beginning, in the morning of the program, we set out to sit you on the shoulder of stories large and small, often early in the day when their world begins.
It's 5 in the morning, and Iraqi army pickup trucks jerk and jostle on a narrow street in their compound. Soldiers dart back and forth across the road, carrying their weapons in one hand and blue bags of breakfast in the other. U.S. Major Dennis Grimsley stands back and watches.
Looks like mass chaos in the American Army, but for the IA, they seem to have a plan. People are just running around, getting the trucks ready, and backing in all over the place. But they have method to their madness, and we always seem to leave on time, so...
In the morning as the tide goes out and pink tourists stake out bandas and lounge chairs, Zulfa Abdallahaji begins her workday. She wades out to her plot of seaweed, about 5 square meters of ocean crossed with what looks like low fences of twine stretched between wooden stakes. Bending from the waist, Haji ties dozens of seedlings about a forearm's length apart to the twine.
Very exciting. It's 4 a.m. as Sylvia Naughty pushes back the sheet and greets the day. It's just becoming light outside as the 36-year-old teacher sweeps her tiny 3-room apartment.
In the morning, I will rise and praise the Lord. Good morning, Jesus.
Her modest concrete dwelling is one of several built to lure teachers like Naughty to this rural part of the country. In a rudimentary kitchen, Naughty makes breakfast. She has no electricity or running water, so she starts a charcoal fire in a pit at her front door. She boils water from a bucket she fills at a borehole once a week. And she whips up donuts to sell at school to supplement her meagre teacher's salary.
Hello, blessing.
Next, it's time to wake the tiny bundle, still sleeping in a bed in the living room.
Say hello, mummy.
Hello, mummy.
It's 4:30 in the morning and this Kuala Lumpur food stand is bustling. The 15 or so plastic tables on the sidewalk are all occupied. And a large screen television is showing a British soccer match.
What do you have there?
It's rice cooked with santan and chicken.
People are eating all they can before sunrise. That's when the azan will sound, the Muslim call to prayer, and the daily fast that takes place during the month of Ramadan will begin.
I've heard that call 1,000 times and still find it transcendent. Funny how sounds like scents from childhood have the power to do that. Some of the most compelling we ever aired were filed from Afghanistan back in 2003 by recently retired CBC correspondent Bill Gillespie. Here's an excerpt from the story that moved Dispatches listeners like no other.
Every day, reporters covering the war would come here and watch the American B-52s drop bombs on the Taliban positions. What we didn't realize at the time was that some of the bombs missed their military targets, falling on a town tucked behind the hills called Hanabad. Abdullah Saeed is standing exactly where he was standing when word raced through this marketplace that American bombs had hit the town. He was selling vegetables from his cart. Immediately, he rushed home. All he could see was a thick cloud of dust and body parts.
When I arrived, there was nothing. The house and the stable were a pile of soil again. All around, there were pieces of flesh, like small pieces of lamb.
In that instant, Abdullah's whole life changed. The house he and his nephew had built with their bare hands, gone. His wife, his nephew's wife, 6 of his 8 children, dead. Another family who had earlier fled the bombing near their own town and were staying with him were all killed, 14 people in all.
We don't hate the Americans. They have brought us peace and stability. The Americans didn't do this on purpose.
What Abdullah does want from the Americans, however, is compensation. Just enough materials or money to rebuild his house. $2,000 at most. So far, the Americans haven't helped. After several emails, the following reply arrived recently from Colonel Rodney Davis, stationed at Bagram Air Base near Kabul. He writes, quote, "A claim is not payable if it results directly or indirectly from an act of the U.S. Armed Forces in combat," unquote. In other words, compensation is only paid if U.S. Armed Forces personnel kill an innocent person when there's not a war going on. But he's more and more pessimistic about getting help from the Americans. He finds it hard to understand why, when America is spending billions of dollars rebuilding Afghanistan's roads and other infrastructure, it can't give him the few thousand dollars it would take to rebuild his house. For Dispatches, I'm Bill Gillespie in Hanabad.
And Bill joins me in studio now. Bill, what goes through your head hearing that all these years later?
Oh, my. This family was so deserving. And it would have been so simple to actually compensate them.
You know, I was struck by the fact that Abdullah says, "I don't blame the Americans."
Typical of many, many Afghans, when the Taliban took over and imposed this draconian, fundamentalist, hyper-religious regime on everybody, they were glad that the Americans had come and gotten rid of the Taliban.
The imagery you used in that piece is powerful. Are there scenes of that that are never going to leave you alone?
Yes, the scenes of the bombs falling. But then going back a year or two later, he had started to rebuild his house, but people were still living in about 3/4 of a stable.
Well, what Dispatches can reveal now is that we received letters by the fistful after that story. Almost every one of them had a check in it for Abdullah. Thousands of dollars rolled in, and what an unexpected dilemma. We wanted to go back and give it to him, but CBC policy prohibits the program acting as a fundraising administrator. I contacted many of the people who'd sent us money. None of them felt qualified to do it. Not to mention there was no real safe way of getting the cash to Abdullah anyway. In the end, I had to return every check, advising, on your advice, they consider sending it to the Red Cross, the only charity you knew of active in the area. In the end, it was frustrating at this end as well. That much cash might have transformed his life or endangered it.
Absolutely. If there aren't banks in Hanabad, he would have had to kept that money in his home. Everyone would have known it. He would become a target. That's why people, every man in Afghanistan has a Kalashnikov, which he keeps close to him at night.
Thanks, Bill, for a remarkable story in the history of Dispatches.
This is my honor.
Retired CBC correspondent Bill Gillespie. And I'm Rick McInnes-Ray, host of CBC Radio's Dispatches, reminding you our website archives will remain online for the next year and a half at cbc.ca/dispatches. And we'll be putting together a bit of a listener's choice page there, full of stories you've told us you want to hear again. If there's a favorite you remember from our vaults, email us, dispatches@cbc.ca, and tell us why. Now, the plight of those caught in the crossfire of global conflicts, like the one from Afghanistan earlier, has been a constant theme in our programming. Time and again, my correspondents documented the ways insecurity and economics drive people from their homes. A story as old as war itself.
I'm standing in the middle of one of the refugee camps in the Turkish border region with Syria. There are six camps in this region. This one is a large one, about 1,800 people here, men, women, and children. Ima Muhammad is sitting on a foam mattress on the ground, her back to a pile of cardboard boxes. Ima's telling me about a phone call she just made to her relatives.
They told me 10 days ago the Syrian forces killed more children. When they held the funeral, people came out to mourn and then snipers started shooting them.
How the killing will end is all these people think about.
It's very difficult. We escaped. My family is safe here. But our relatives and friends, so many of them are still at home. It's very dangerous for them.
The lineup at a water pump in yet another refugee camp. But this one is on the outskirts of the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. These people are refugees from Sudan's other war, the one with the south. Fighting between the Muslim north and the Christian and animist south has killed more than 2 million people and displaced another 4 million. And the southerners say what's happening in Darfur is much like what happened to them. Anthony Black used to be a math teacher in the southern city of Juba. He fled the fighting there more than a decade ago and hasn't had a steady job since.
The problem is these people, they want to clear the black people in Africa here. That is their main aim.
These people, what do you mean by these people?
The Arabs.
23-year-old Zhong Jiangshu has the top bunk on the right, the one closest to the noise of the traffic below. His clothes, his TV, his life is crammed into a space not much bigger than a coffin. But at least he's avoided the beds under the leaky roof, patched with the peeling newspaper, and those at the back near the broken windows. Zheng had plans to go to university, but his family had money problems. So now he sends cash home so his younger brother can go. But he sets a little aside. He's got future plans of his own.
There are people who have worked here and later became bosses, became independent. Always working for someone else is not good in the long run.
About 25 actors are auditioning today for parts in a new movie called Dangerous Decision. It's being taped and produced in the camp by Royal Liberian Films, a collective of actors, writers, and directors, all refugees who live here. Rishlu Burfi is one of them.
There are a lot of people here who acted back in Liberia before the war, you see it? So that passion is still in them.
That passion has produced a prolific movie industry here on this sprawling camp that still houses 20,000 refugees from Liberia's civil war.
I also meet Patricia at the shelter. She's brushing out her long, tangled black hair on another bed. The deeply religious 30-year-old Honduran tells me Satan is always out to trick people. She says she's in God's hands as she travels. Still, she got a contraceptive shot before she left, too.
Yes, I got injection just in case, and because I'm going there. If you say, I'm going to get raped, and you think, I'm going to get raped, then you're going to get raped.
She got the shot because a woman at her church, back in San Pedro Sula, suggested it.
Inside the boat? See our rooms, you know, see where I live?
This man points to his bed, made with scraps of foam and a pile of blankets. Most of the black Africans here tell me they've arrived here over the past month. They had to flee the anti-Qaddafi forces after the rebels began liberating the towns along the coast. Dark-skinned men on the streets were being rounded up, accused of being Qaddafi's mercenaries.
If black, they're not like, they catch you. You understand?
You're listening to the Dispatches podcast, the final edition, as we look back at some of the stories our correspondents have brought you over 12 seasons. Some, we have to admit, were hard to stomach. Literally. During the worst of the Bosnian War, our nightly diet in the basement bunker was mystery soup and bread of such distinctive shape, it was quickly called the penis bun. Much more palatable was this night out, recounted by CBC correspondent Jennifer Westaway.
This is probably supposed to be profound and deeply moving, and it's about booze and food. Dispatches sent me a few years ago to Japan, and my translator said I would need to bring gifts for my Japanese interviewees, businessmen especially. And I did, and I also bought a crazy expensive bottle of scotch. It came in a crystal decanter in a velvet box. That was for my translator. Before I got to Tokyo, my sister, who is married to a Japanese Canadian, had let slip that I was going to be in Tokyo for a couple of days. And so nothing would do but that I have dinner with the family, and that was fine. It sounded like fun. My first clue when I got to the restaurant, we had no conversation with the waiter. Clearly, this had all been prearranged. And for the next several hours, dish after dish, 24 in all, came out of the kitchen like nothing I had ever seen before. Sushi dish, sashimi actually, it was fish where the scales were made of raw fish. It had been cut to look like a fish right out of the ocean, glittering there on the table. There was a platter made to look like a Japanese garden. They had fashioned bonsai trees out of seaweed, and the cut gravel pathways were made out of crushed salt. It was endless, it was exquisite, and unforgettable. The family spent most of their time looking at me, making sure that I was eating, that I was enjoying it, and that all sounds incredibly uncomfortable, and frankly, I couldn't have cared less. I was in heaven, and I knew it, and believe you me, I gave them the scotch. Thanked them profusely, wrote a very long thank you note, but what I didn't have a chance to do at the time was thank the crew at Dispatches for making it possible for me to have the meal of a lifetime. Arigato gozaimasu. Thank you, guys.
A tough job, but we're glad Jennifer Westaway got to do it. Looking back, you know, it's surprising how many of our stories turned on food, though some dining out on this program suffered less tasteful results. Can you say bug nuggets?
I prepared bug nuggets and bug sticks. They look like chicken nuggets, but they are filled with bugs.
That's right, bug nuggets.
First I have to pull off his wings. Your stomach can't digest them.
There are enough bug farmers here in the Netherlands, 16 in total, for them to have their own association. What does it taste like to you?
I think a dead bug.
There are a lot of penis on this menu. Bull penis, deer penis, dog penis, snake penis, sheep penis. You cannot imagine how many penis there are.
We can have our choice of spicy Sichuan or a sweet one with ham and fish heads and nine different kinds of emulsified house specialty, a kind of genitalia gumbo.
We put the broth on the hot plate, and then our nutritionists will explain the healthy reasons for eating this to you. And we will drop different penises into the broth one by one. I'd recommend you try the ox penis. It's very strong and nutritious.
If you're touring Europe and say, do you have anything in Sweden that is special? Everybody say yes. Surströmming.
Do you know about this fish, the surströmming? I know I don't say it properly.
Yeah, my grandmother, when she opens up the cans, it was terrified by the smell when I was small, you know. So, but I've heard that EU is trying to regulate against the surströmming,
yes,
in large amounts.
Lots of dioxin.
So maybe my grandmother could be in the risk zone.
Because she eats it so much.
The taste is terrible and the smell, you know,
It smells like shit.
But that's the gas only. Then you have the liquid, the brine. That smells differently.
So
you have some barriers you have to pass. I flew once to South Dakota, to Sioux City. I think they have a lot of pig farms there.
Oh. So this doesn't smell as bad as a pig farm?
Absolutely not. This is an art form to do this.
He slices some boiled potatoes and places them on a piece of dry flatbread.
Absolutely microscopic.
Oh, so that's just a sliver.
Yeah. Then you take a sour cream, like a pearl in a necklace.
Mm-hmm.
Then some onion, red onion is better than sweet. And then you take a tomato, just for the color, more or less. Then you have some dill.
Wow, it looks beautiful.
Yeah.
We're in a food court, looking for Brunei's signature dish. It's made from the trunk of the sago palm that has been ground up and strained. She adds hot water to the powder and mixes it to the perfect consistency. Sitting in front of me is this white bowl filled with this substance. It's very sticky. It almost looks like glue. Or snail trails, or the result of a prolonged sneezing session. But waiting and debating whether to eat it won't help. Ambuyat is best steaming hot before it congeals. The people from Brunei put a big glob on.
Yeah.
And they take that in one bite?
It's very easy.
So, what brings VIPs and tourism students to this remote farm? What Ivar cooks up. The Norwegian delicacy, smalahove.
Yeah.
I peer inside the stock pots sitting on gas stoves outside the farmhouse kitchen. Sheep's heads with the eyes and cheekbones intact. Weighted down with pieces of slate to prevent the heads from bobbing, they're boiling for the school group's dinner.
So now we're going to get the sheep heads.
Ivar is outside the kitchen, draining the boiled sheep's heads onto a wooden tray.
10
halves of heads per tray with 10 viscous eyes staring out from their lifeless sockets and 10 black orifices where the ears would have been with rutabaga mash on the side.
Okay, I'm going to cut in now. Oh, God. Do you have any water?
You're going to survive.
I am. Oh!
Don't you like the taste of it?
No.
Oh, the smell is not good. I'm getting a little bit of a quiver when I smell it too deeply. I'm going to not breathe for a second.
After you eat this, when you have that beer, it'll be the best tasting
beer. Okay, here we go.
Beer.
Oh. Mm-hmm. It's like almost a sharp taste. Oh, I find it strong, I have to say. But, you know, with all of the things on it, it's kind of nice.
Did you touch it at all?
No.
No?
Why? It looks disgusting. I'm sorry.
Swallow it whole, she tells us.
Oh my goodness. And then, okay, so I just eat it, right?
It's quite good. I like it.
She puts out 3 dipping sauces and hands us our chopsticks.
Me first?
Yeah, first, behind you.
Sometimes they don't pay me enough for this.
There has to be a restroom around here somewhere.
The CBC's Anthony Germain in China at the end there a couple years ago, putting paid, I think, to the idea correspondent's life is all 5 stars and open bars. In fact, I'm reminded of a possibly apocryphal story about a journalist doing a piece about a sniper, only to be horrified when the man turned and shot 2 people entirely for his benefit. In this business, you be careful what you wish for, as Jared Ferry learned running down a drug story for us in the West African state of Guinea-Bissau.
It was one of the most bizarre but interesting and memorable reporting trips I've ever done. I was with this photographer, Lauren Lancaster, who was working with the National at the time. We spent a lot of time trying to find these guys that were getting hooked on crack. And it wasn't easy. I mean, we went through 4 or 5 fixers that week. They kept quitting on us. Because we kept asking them to go into these kind of sketchy neighborhoods. And then finally we met this guy and he said, I can show you where the young guy smoked some crack and I can show you a kilo of cocaine. And I remember my heart just kind of leapt into my chest and I thought, obviously this isn't safe, but sure enough, he brought us into this sort of crack den. These young guys were smoking crack and they were fine with us being there. And we were, you know, I was kind of asking them questions and recording and the photographer was snapping away. And then next thing you know, this huge guy walks in. He's like got gold chains. I don't know if he's high, but his eyes were popping out of his head. And he's just walked into the room. And he started yelling at the guy that brought us there. And our fixer got really nervous and she said, okay, we got to get out of here. And he's accusing you of being cops, like of being agents with Interpol. We walked out. He followed after us and he was yelling. And we had a mob surrounding us and they were banging on the top of the truck. And the guys that were, you know, we were formerly hanging out with watching them smoke crack, all of a sudden they, at least to my mind at the moment, turned into these kind of fiends that were pushing and grabbing and even sort of punching at my shoulder. And then I noticed this guy walked into the middle of the mob and then he started talking to these young guys and he was cooling them down a little bit. And it turns out he was an off-duty cop. He called his buddies at the police station and this pickup truck full of cops just kind of drove into the middle of this crowd. They dispersed the crowd a little bit and then they kind of talked to the drug dealer and they made a plan. We would all go back to the police station. We walked in and this big drug dealer guy, he bumps fists with the cops there. And finally the cop came over to us and said, okay, you erase your files and we'll let you go. The photographer erased all her photos right in front of him, deleted them all. And then he came over to me and I would play the sound file and then I'd show him that I was deleting it. You know, I thought, it's a shame I lost those recordings, but you know what? It's lucky that we escaped with our lives, really. So we walked out of the police station and I just felt so relieved. And Lauren, my friend who was the photographer, turned to me and said, you know, we can get those files back. And I was just thinking like, you're kidding me. I mean, this is amazing. As it turns out, you can rescue all this stuff. There's programs you can find on the internet that just bring it back up. I mean, that was really cool to be able to bring those files back was amazing. And I think it really helped out with the story as well. The whole trip was this sequence of bizarre but lucky happenings.
Freelance journalist Jared Ferry with the background to a story he survived to tell. Then there's this from our longtime contributor Megan Williams in Rome.
A couple of weeks ago, I was a juror at a small fledgling radio documentary festival in Italy. Well, it's really a film festival, held in the tiny Adriatic coastal town of Bellaria. Last year, the organizers decided it was time to honor the radio documentary, a rare form in Italy, where cheaply produced news and talk shows and phone-in shows take up pretty much all the airtime. When I got to the festival, I found out I was the only foreign jury member. Why me? Because I was Canadian, the organizer said. And Canada, that is the CBC, has such a long committed tradition of making great radio documentaries. Unlike Italy, he added, Canada invests in radio documentaries. For the next 2 days, I listened to a whole range of Italian radio docs. Some conveyed interesting information. Others tackled tough topics, like female genital mutilation. But honestly, none was as good as what regularly airs on CBC shows like, well, this one. The producers and reporters who made them likely spend most of their time under the pressure cooker of producing news. They could convey information well. But what was missing from the reports was sound, voices, silence, and time. All the elements you need to really transport a listener from her car or his living room to a complicated, subtle, intimate elsewhere. A shanty town in Phnom Penh, or a Chinese sweatshop in small town Italy, or a garden in an imperiled oasis far into the Egyptian desert. Places that, with dispatches, I've been incredibly fortunate to have the time and space to bring to listeners. Places that CBC listeners won't be visiting so often. For the last time, for Dispatches, I'm Megan Williams in Rome.
Canadian journalist Megan Williams there in Rome. And I'm Rick McInnes-Ray. This is the podcast of CBC Radio's Dispatches. You'll find it along with podcasts of many other CBC Radio programs on the website cbc.ca/podcasting. Coming up on this final podcast of Dispatches, stories that transported us in more ways than one. But first, some correspondence dish on Dispatches. Each week in this program, we promised you dispatches from our correspondents around the world. And joining me now are three who filed many of them. Margaret Evans is the CBC's Europe correspondent in London. Anthony Germain was the CBC's China correspondent for 5 years. And Connie Watson is the CBC's Latin America correspondent based in Rio. And you all have done pieces I will never forget, but what are some that you won't? Connie?
The thing I love about Dispatches is that it lets us tell a story and not just report one. I remember one of the first things I did for you was the trip to Afghanistan when I tried on a burqa, and me and my preconceived notions, which Dispatches has helped to knock out as well, the idea that, oh, these must be horrible things. And when I tried it on, a couple of women came in and got the giggles watching me because, of course, it was too small for my head. And I thought, oh, this must be a horrible thing. And they say, no, we make a living out of sewing these things. And plus, the men don't ogle us, and we get a bit of an anonymity from it. So I was really surprised at that. And then that led to me being invited to a women's shower in Afghanistan. And that was one of the raunchiest women's showers I've ever been to in my life. There were sexual dances, and they were putting heavy makeup on themselves and me. And it's one of those afternoons I'll never forget. But it just allows you a way in that a regular reporting job doesn't.
Anthony, where's the covering for Dispatches led you?
What I always liked about Dispatches was the range of stories you could actually attack when you wanted to paint on the canvas of your show, Rick. And what I mean by that is, on the one hand, you could explore something such as the neo-colonization of Africa by the Chinese, or you could also do a feature on a restaurant chain in Beijing that serves nothing but animal penises. And what Dispatches has meant to me is traveling around the world and also eating some of the most horrible food a person could ever ingest. And I think for that one item, I think it was the genitalia of a boar that I ended up eating. And to me, the beauty of Dispatches is that it really allowed you to explore the complexity of the world, the humor of the world, and the humanity of the world.
Margaret Evans in London, one from your list.
Like Anthony says, it is the perfect storm, this show for a journalist, driving out to a refugee camp in western Darfur. I remember the music in the cab of this truck we were jammed into. I remember this sort of scarecrow refugee camp. I remember the man who said to me, you know, I don't believe the sun will rise anymore. And you use the sounds, you use your own words. It's a writer's dream. And on top of all that, you get to take that story back to Canadians, and they wouldn't get it without it, and you have the time to give them context and understanding. It's been an amazing program and experience for that, and on top of that, it is wonderfully irreverent.
What did you look for in a story when you pitched Dispatches?
One of the joys of working for the show is when you have people like Steve McMalley, Alison Maceman, Donna Dingwall, Alan Gattell actually giving you advice before you hit the road. So you actually have a sense of, okay, I'm going to try and get this, try to get that, and see what happens. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. But I remember one particular story. I think it had to do with the nuclear industry in China. And I think it was Gattell, I'm not sure. But he said, you know, we really want somebody, a real environmentalist, to actually talk about the nuclear industry and what some of the concerns in China are. And I remember, oh, this is going to be great. I found this guy on a blog. He's outspoken. I talked to him on the phone, and he talked about the nuclear industry being a clear and present danger. So I figured, okay, I'll set this up. So he agrees to meet with me in a coffee shop. He's afraid he's being followed, as a lot of people who do interviews in China do. And by the time I get to him, he's totally drunk the government Kool-Aid and starts to spew forth how nuclear energy has been wisely chosen by the Communist Party as a wise road for prosperity down the future. And I realized that somebody got to him, or he'd had second thoughts. And you go back to the producer and Dispatch, so you're not going to believe this. The guy was a dud. And you start over again, and eventually you find somebody. And what I really loved about working with Dispatches was the amount of thought. Working for World Report and the World at Six is great. But to really get underneath how things work, there simply was no place like Dispatches.
Connie, let me come to you on that question. What did you want when you were building a Dispatch? What did you want in it?
I remember one that I was thinking, dispatches better bloody love this piece. Mexicans who didn't have to run for the border and work illegally in the States would pay to go to this theme park to find out what it was like. And, oh, I had, I didn't know where to put my mic because we were literally hanging off rock faces and rolling in mud and were being chased by federales. I felt like it just was a little more than I could deliver, but at the end it turned out pretty well, and I thought I'll just have to delete all the swear words that inadvertently made it to tape.
Margaret, I can still hear your description all those years ago of watercraft whispering through the reeds of the Iraqi marshes. You paint word pictures in pastel.
Well, Dispatches allows you to do that. The water buffalo kind of snorting up from the dark of the water, and you do go through some hardships to get the story. Sometimes I think Dispatches, is, I should entitle it, Stories I've Never Told My Mother, that airplane that you shouldn't get on, where everybody's got a goat on their lap. Incredibly difficult times, putting sometimes the people you work with at risk. If you can remember back to when texting was new, I remember being in Khartoum and our translator was arrested, and I was working with a producer, a very well-known CBC producer at the time named Edith Champagne, and we didn't want to be separated by the authorities from our translator, so one of us went with him and the other went in the car behind, and we were texting each other. I always remember that because I was very dismissive of texting, thinking, oh, this newfangled technology. But it's life experience as a journalist kind of coalesced into this. And like I said, there are a lot of stories I don't know that maybe I'll tell my mom not to listen this time around.
I remember vividly, though, you survived an airstrike on your motorcade in Iraq. We always asked people to give it their all, and they always came back sometimes with stories about facing deadly peril. Was it like that for you, Anthony?
The earthquake in Sichuan was probably the worst disaster I've covered, because not only did you have 70,000 dead and all the destruction, all that, but these aftershocks would just scare the living hell out of you every time that happened. You'd be running out of your hotel room. As the show evolved, particularly when the show started to produce those the View From Here segments, I think as the CBC morphed into an organization where people file for radio, for TV, for the web, the show adapted to the work demands that are made on all correspondents in the field. And I love the fact that some producer from Dispatches would call, or Rick, you would call and say, look, just take a tape recorder, you've got 5 minutes, and just give us the view from X, from wherever you were. And in my case, I remember actually being in India, and I was just struck by how, compared to China, nothing seemed to work, and everybody was trying to hose me for money. And I just let one go and talked about the view from where I was in northern India. And when I listened back to it, I said, that's not damn bad. I'm going to send that.
Connie, sometimes the peril doesn't have to be a disaster. It's just perilous moving around some of the countries you've had to work. What's that been like?
Well, I think back on the natural disaster front, and it's still perilous to move around in Haiti. One of the last times I was in there, I went to see this voodoo hex that Haitians believed had been put on them in an area where they're big believers in voodoo. Me, the motorbike driver, and my fixer behind me. So we're three on a Haitian motorbike that, of course, is a Chinese motorbike, because that's what all Haitians are using now. And we went for an hour and a half on that. And I thought, I don't think I can even get up off this bike now with my old knees. But I did, and then we ran for a plane and just barely got it before he left the runway. We ended up with a brilliant story. But the traveling is often something that you don't realize is actually part of the story. And some of them you don't really get to tell. As much as we do get to tell on Dispatches, there's still more.
We've always asked you, apart from interviews and question and answer sessions and Views From Here, for documentaries. We aren't the only outlet in the CBC for documentary making, but we won't be here to do any more after this. And I just wondered if you each had an individual take on the craft as we move forward.
Well, I think it's a sad fact, Rick, that whether it's Dispatches, which will be no more, or some of our other shows on CBC Radio, that the documentary, either the long format radio piece, to me, is on its way out. And I think the fact that Dispatches is going to be no longer is evidence of that. But for journalists and news reporters, anybody who's out there in the field covering a dangerous situation, war, earthquakes, tsunamis, whatever it is, you really want to be able to have the time to do something which only a documentary can do, and that is to bring a listener right to the place where you're reporting. I can talk to you on the phone and say this is happening, that's happening, like a news reporter does, but the only way to use the magic of the medium is through the documentary. And I think it's a shame at a time when every high school student in this country is being told that he or she is going to grow up in a world where they're going to be working for the Chinese or for Brazilians or for Europeans. Globalization is the word of the day, and we find ourselves in a situation where we're getting rid of a show that highlights and showcases the world in all of its marvelous complexity. It really boggles the mind.
Connie, your thoughts?
Those long documentaries were like a therapy, a way to deal with feelings and words and senses and scenes that have been eating you up if you're in a dangerous place, if you're in a tumultuous place, if you're in a really emotional spot. And it really helps. Dispatches was a way for an outlet that really helped us pour ourselves into things. And I thank you so much, even all this time later, for letting me have 23 minutes to describe the complexities that are Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. And that was a long time ago before everyone, you know, put him down into a 2-second bite and tried to characterize him with two words. And the man is not that easy to characterize. And you gave me 23 minutes to talk about the country and the leader. And it helped me. It helped listeners. And we are really, really going to miss that on the CBC.
Margaret Evans in London, your take on the state of the craft?
We did a documentary about water in the Middle East, and we went all the way from Turkey down through Syria, over the Golan Heights, into the Negev Desert. On that journey, I think we provided listeners with context of a very complex subject, but it heralded things to come. The same thing for the program that the show did, the award-winning program that she put together on democracy. It was prescient in terms of looking ahead to what was happening in the Middle East, and I don't think we're going to have that anymore, and that's a shame, especially as we're struggling to understand all of these things that are sweeping the various parts of the world that we're covering.
Folks, I wish you all continuing success. It's been a profound pleasure and honor working with you all over these years. Thank you for bringing me the world.
Thanks, Rick.
It's been a pleasure, Rick.
We're going to miss you like crazy. Bye.
Bye-bye. CBC correspondents Margaret Evans, Anthony Germain, and Connie Watson. And I'm Rick McInnes-Ray in Canada. You're listening to the podcast of The Last Dispatches. There's more material on our website, cbc.ca/dispatches, where you can also download the special supersized podcast. There are comments there from hundreds of fellow listeners and links to all the stories we've touched on in this week's program.
My name is Laura Lynch. Over the years, my work for Dispatches has taken me to Zimbabwe several times, and for the most part, I managed to gain permission to report from that troubled land. But the trip that remains most vivid for me was in the fall of 2007, when I entered the country undercover, because Robert Mugabe's regime was barring almost all foreign journalists. I was accompanied by a CBC cameraman, Richard Deavy, for the trip, and we knew it was a risk. The night before, I barely slept, knowing that getting caught would almost certainly mean a stay in the country's notoriously nasty jails. We flew into Zimbabwe's second city, Bulawayo, hoping we might have an easier time slipping through immigration there. The immigration hall was really just a crumbling airport hangar. We went in and filled out our cards. I called myself a lawyer, and it's true, I was called to the bar in BC in 1989. Richard listed himself as a musician. Also true, though his days of rocking at nightclubs were pretty much past. We waited for them to look at our bags after telling them we'd come on a bird-watching holiday in order to explain the small camera. Our biggest concern was the tripod encased in a red duffel bag. It was an odd shape, and the woman on duty looked it over several times before she asked us to open it. We tried, but it was bound with tape that had been applied at the airport in Johannesburg to prevent theft. We were starting to get nervous as the woman's determination to open the bag grew. There was only one solution, she said, as she went off to get a pair of scissors. We waited 5, 10, 20 minutes as we watched the other passengers leave. And yes, I was getting worried. Then she returned, scowling. "We have no scissors in this airport," she complained. In a country that had already lost so much, including any respect for the lives and rights of so many of its own people, it really wasn't a surprise that the scissors disappeared too. She led us through with a dismissive wave of her hand. This was our welcome to Mugabe's crippled nation, trying to hide its ugly reality from the world. A reality Dispatch's listeners have come to know well over the years.
The CBC's Laura Lynch with memories of covering a country for us that's become a faded memory of itself. Fact is, whether it's curious customs officials or withering warlords, correspondents actually do spend rather a lot of time answering questions. But as host of Dispatches, I always got to ask them, often to people in pretty remarkable circumstances. Would you tell me what happened that day in West Bengal when you were with the police officer and he opens the door of the SUV?
He opened it up and inside there were these four, you know, sizable, hefty bags full of human bones. And the police undertaker opened up these bags and tossed them on the ground and out rolled about 100 human skulls along with femurs.
Tell me, if you would, what is the point of these kidnappings in Georgia? What started it?
In Tbilisi, in other cities and regions, urban areas and villages, it was very common to kidnap a woman with a purpose of marriage. I've experienced three cases of this full kidnapping. And first I was 14. I was like a schoolgirl and, you know, very active.
Which of your campaign promises will you be delivering on first? The towels, the bear, the Disneyland? What do you have in mind?
Well, the polar bear, because I think it's a very serious matter. Polar bears have been coming to Iceland with drift ice from Greenland, and they're usually shot at arrival. I want to change that and set up an enclosure, a facility in the Reykjavik Zoo.
When the tsunami hit, you jumped in your car, you drove 24 hours to get to the affected area. What was your initial impression of the devastation?
When I first saw it, it was just really breathtaking in the literal sense of the word. I found it hard to breathe for a second just because I had never seen an entire town flattened in that sort of way where...
Okay, we'd like to listen in to what you're doing. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I'm working with a wonderful Sierra Leone midwife, and she's about to teach some of the health workers how to use a fetal Doppler. And if you wait just a moment, you may be able to hear a baby's heartbeat.
Great. We're listening in.
So we're trying to listen to the fetal heartbeat.
Just hold it still. You found it.
It's pretty amazing for me to think I'm listening to a baby's heartbeat on the other side of the world in rural Africa, and possible because of this solar suitcase of yours. Can you describe it? Describe what's
in
it?
Can you tell me what happened during that raid on your station? Exactly what did they do?
They followed some of our people, and when they entered the building, they surrounded it by a team of security cars and people. They entered the building and they arrested all the people who were inside the building, regardless whether they're working for Radio Dabanga or not. The people in the building who were picked up are journalists, human rights activists, and lawyers. And they're all working in a network of Darfurian people who try to cover the issues in Darfur.
What does the inside of a leopard seal's mouth look like?
She came over to me and engulfed my camera and my head in her mouth. A head bigger than a grizzly bear's, with a mouth that's much bigger than a grizzly bear's. Got her canines on over the top of my head and her bottom canines down below my jaw, so I'm staring down her throat. But you also see these bicuspid molars going down the backside of the mouth, and those molars are specially designed for either cutting the flesh of an animal like a penguin or a seal.
Your film is delicious, I have to say. A parade of chocolate and pastry and exquisite ingredients. The sugar sculptures, they're wildly imaginative. And that seems, you know, so quintessentially French. Chris, can you describe some of them for us?
Well, some of them are, you know, about 5 feet tall. A lot of them were, you know, had a lot of flowers on them, which were pulled sugar. Some were sculptures.
Tell me about the man you call Major.
His father-in-law was the leader of this motorcycle gang, and they were big into the production and distribution of methamphetamine. They took the filters that they used to filter the impurities from their dope, and they would put them in a microwave oven. Major was cooking his children's macaroni and cheese and whatever else in the same microwave. When the Department of Human Services finally took his child or his children from him, they both had the highest hair cell follicle count of meth in the history of Iowa.
You describe this as the most unappealing health crisis in the world. And I wonder, would you tell me an incident from your travels, your research that brings those two ideas, really brought them home for you?
We were stopped by oxen on a village road in the middle of rural India. I opened the door to get out of the car just to pass some time, and my companion said to me, "Be careful, you're about to step on the village toilet." And I looked around, and sure enough, all around me were evidence that people had been using the roadside as their toilet, and because they had nothing else. So that's about as unpleasant as it is.
You know, back in the day, high school hallways were full of kids and teachers, but you spoke to students like this John Travers and found out there's a new element in the halls these days. What is John's story?
Well, John Travers was a young African-American man who I met at a shopping mall in Maryland, not far from Washington, D.C., and I was there looking to find young people's experience with military recruiters. And I asked John, who was 19 years old, and, you know, what experience had he had with military recruiters? And he said that, well, to get lunch in my high school, you had to pass recruiters.
It's Mr. Mugabe's birthday this week. Anything you'd like to say to him, if you could?
May you please resign is my message for his birthday.
Some of the answers there that have resonated with us here at Dispatches over the years. But it was a story about a quest for some answers that stays with our longtime contributor, Rhoda Metcalf.
One of the most pleasurable stories I ever did for Dispatches took me to southern Turkey in search of whirling dervishes. The dervishes are Sufis. They practice a mystical form of Islam that's been outlawed in Turkey for decades. But I was told I could still find a dervish community in Konya, the city where the sect was founded 700 years ago. And I did find them in a small house on a quiet street. And at first, I thought I'd walked in on some kind of family picnic. A dozen women were at the back cooking dinner with children running around them. The men were all in the front chatting. But after the food, the drums began to beat and the men began to chant. I started out in the back room with the women, listening through the wall. But the women were just sitting, and I knew I was missing all the action. So I tiptoed into the front and sat down with the men. There must have been 50 men squeezed into a circle. They were kneeling, and their bodies were rocking and swaying to the beat of the drum. They chanted the name of God over and over until sweat ran down their faces. And when the spirit took them, one or two would stand up and begin to whirl and whirl. Pretty soon I found my own body swaying to the beat. The music was hypnotic, and I could feel their joy, their sense of rising up towards something above us. And then the drumming stopped, and we all came back down to earth. I'm not a religious person, but that evening I got a glimpse of that mystical struggle to know God.
If faith can transport us, as Rhoda Metcalf discovered, so can a great story. Come to think of it, a lot of ours were actually set on transportation, on trains, planes, and automobiles, reminding us that travel's not always about the destination. Sometimes the voyage is its own reward.
A column of low-slung boats floats down a narrow waterway, long poles pushing off from the beds below, elegant prows nosing their way through a maze of reeds. The strange gondoliers of the marshes have returned, standing as straight and tall as the reeds they're navigating. When the narrow streams give way to open space and sunlight catches the algae coating the water's surface, they seem to be gliding through sand.
So we came out of County Cork and we went into Tipperary?
Tipperary, yeah. Bypassing Cashel now.
I'm in the Irish Republic, driving north with a friend from Cork, Colm Clarkin. His grandfather was an IRA man, and like me, Colm's never been to the north. Well, except for a few hours once, just over the border.
You mentioned last night that you were worried that with your license plate, someone might throw something at your car. Could that happen?
Sure. If you happen to go through the wrong area, which may be unionist, and they see a car with southern license plates, you're attracting trouble. It's a red rag to a bull.
Divya Joshi dangles the key to her tiny Maruti 800. The little car takes the young Indian mother to work, to the market, and to visit friends. Its helper reach a level of mobility her own mother could never have dreamed of.
From the time I bought a car and I started going on my own to places, it definitely has given me much more freedom.
I sit in the back seat of a police cruiser as it heads to the outskirts of Prato. The officers are heading to a small cluster of brick factories that Italians call capannoni, factory workshops. Commissaria Flora Leone is leading the operation. She tells me they're acting on information that Chinese sweatshops are operating in the buildings. With two backup officers and a Chinese translator, they hustle to the side door.
I board the Prince of the Amazon, one of the boats casting off, to ride downstream for about an hour. Frequent traveler Silvio Camaleon is already settled into his hammock, sandals kicked off, book on his belly, ready for his 20-hour voyage to Parintins. I really like traveling like this, he says. It's really, really, really good. Because it's not exhausting. I nap a little and meet other people on board.
As Imama Sidibe stops his power K at a market stall, he drags on a cigarette and waits to be served. This is the third Chinese motorcycle that he's owned. He doesn't care about the World Bank's numbers. All that matters to Sidibe and his fellow Malians is the price. Because here we don't have a lot of money, he says, so we like the Chinese motorcycles.
Je suis prêt.
Are you ready? Sidibe asks. I'm ready, I tell him.
Ce n'est pas un bon goudron maintenant.
This is not a good road, I say. Yes, yes, Sidibe tells me.
The Friday train from Zagreb to Vukovar is packed. It's hard to find even a standing spot in the hallway between the compartments. People are quiet. The cars are clearly marked as non-smoking, but a blue haze fills the air. As a child, I would visit my mother's family in Vukovar. I remember swimming in the Danube and my great aunt's cakes, magnificent, creamy towers of decadence.
See, sometimes everyday transport is much more than just that. Just listen to the CBC's Bruce Edwards. He once had a car that ended up revealing to him that things are not always as they appear.
I'm Bruce Edwards, and I'm lucky enough to have come to know some of the unluckiest people in the world, thanks to this show, Dispatches. One of the last stories I filed was about poor South African workers trying to reclaim farmland seized under apartheid. The heart of the story was in Limpopo province on the border with Zimbabwe, and where I found myself late one evening on a deserted back road with a bent rim, a hissing tire, and an ominous setting sun. I'd been there earlier that day with a white farmer who'd refused to relinquish his farm. He wanted to show me the dilapidated state of one farm that had been transferred to a group of black workers. These people, it turns out, had very little farming experience, and so this once highly productive mango farm now stood in ruins, pillaged by its new owners. Even the water pipes had been ripped out of the ground. I'd left there feeling a lot of tension between the locals and the white farmer, and at the end of the day decided to go back without him to get some photos. So I'm driving down this heavily rippled dirt road in my totally inadequate little rental car when I slam into a pothole only a few meters from the farm and forced to stop. Of course, there's no jack in the trunk, and as I'm kicking dirt wondering what to do, a small group of somewhat menacing-looking locals emerge from the bushes, some carrying lengths of this cast-iron pipe. I fear now they recognize me from earlier in the day, and as they approach, one guy actually stops to pick up a large rock on the side of the road. Well, just as I'm wondering if my dispatch will ever make it to air, one of them slips the big rock behind the damaged tire, while the others start using the pipes to lift the front end of the car. It turns out they'd come to help, and ironically, what they used to change my tire were bits that had been pillaged from the mango farm's irrigation system. A few mango trees was all they needed, they said, and the pipes were of more use to them above ground than below. Although none of this ever made it into the land reform story, the experience gave me a better understanding of those people I was there to write about. So Dispatches has not only enriched a whole lot of listeners, it's been equally enriching for us contributors as well.
The CBC's Bruce Edwards. Well, sometimes what you learn on the road with Dispatches is how the experience can make you just a little crazy. Freelance journalist Lindsay McKenzie found that out, rushing to make a flight on Air Felix out of Yemen.
My interview with the governor of Aden had run long. Once he found out I was Canadian, well, he had a son that he was sending to business school in Canada. What were my thoughts, and what were people like there? With just a few minutes to spare, I ran to the Air Felix counter, only to be told I actually had hours to spare. My flight was cancelled. Something to do with a sandstorm. The next one wasn't for 8 hours at midnight. Oh, but it was full. I exhaled and reminded myself of the futility of getting frustrated in Yemen. Patience is a necessity for survival here. If you aren't patient, you will almost certainly be crazy. I had to be in Sana'a by 4 a.m. to make a connecting flight. Foreigners aren't allowed to drive due to the kidnapping risk, so I had to try my luck on the midnight flight. I headed to the nearby waterfront cafe, where I worked on my Dispatches story until my laptop battery died. After that, I could only sit and dwell on the irony of the fact that the airline that was causing me so much anxiety was named Felix, meaning happy or lucky in Latin. I went back to the nearly empty airport at 10 p.m. The agent smiled and told me to wait. The next time I inquired, I was told to wait a little longer. Finally, a sympathetic ticket agent gave me a mischievous look and told me not to worry. He thought I could get a seat. There was a whispered discussion behind the counter, and then I was handed a ticket. The space under seat number was empty. When the 50-seat Bombardier jet finally rolled in on the tarmac 2 hours late, I lined up to get on. The friendly agent was directing passengers to their seats. But when he saw me, he blocked my way and gave me a polite shove in the opposite direction. "You will sit here," he said, and he bundled me into the cockpit. I was a bit stunned as I watched the captain unfold the jump seat. I sat down, and then he welcomed me by giving me his dinner. 45 minutes later, the patchwork of lights came into view, and we guessed at which parts of the city looked as if they had electricity. Just before landing, my seatmate called a flight attendant and had her bring extra sandwiches for me. I stepped off the plane just in time to make my connection, my camera bag now bursting with plastic-wrapped egg sandwiches and bottles of water, courtesy of the captain. As it turned out, Air Felix had lived up to its name, after all.
Journalist Lindsay McKenzie there, bringing us to the end of the day for Dispatches and into its evening, when things are put away and retired. But even then, life goes on, as we've heard over the years.
Nighttime in downtown Monrovia. Young Liberians mingle and flirt in the yellow glow of streetlights. Music booms from a rundown shopfront turned nightclub. Their clothes are scruffy interpretations of American rap fashion, created from Western cast-offs now selling cheaply in markets here.
Yes, we are having a lot of fun here tonight because the street lights.
Boys like this saw street lights for the first time in July, when President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf switched on Monrovia's rebuilt electricity grid. With lights and a new Western-trained police force, Liberia's youth have discovered nightlife, and they're making up for lost time.
Could you do that when there were no streetlights?
Oh, no. It would be very fearful. Yeah. Yes, it's much better now because no more shagaba, no more chopping people because of the streetlight.
It's a displaced persons camp, left over from Sierra Leone Civil War. There are dozens of huts spread chaotically around a giant field. It's just after sunset, and mothers are boiling rice for dinner. I can smell the cassava leaves boiling on the cooking fires. After wandering around the camp asking for Abdullahi, we find him. It's completely dark now, and Abdullah and his mother are sitting on the ground in front of a large bowl of rice. Abdullah's mother is proud of him. He supports his family, and they won't go hungry like so many do in Sierra Leone.
Nighttime in Messina, women in short skirts and plunging tops walk the streets off the main road waiting for clients.
How many women work the street at night?
It's too much.
Too much?
Her name is Precious. She stayed to talk when the other prostitutes scattered as we approached. She is, like the others, from Zimbabwe. She wears a wig, a candy pink t-shirt emblazoned with the words sweet love and the hardened look of a survivor. Precious tells me her time is precious too, and so we arrange to meet the next day.
The Maasai kept dancing for almost an hour under the starry sky. But after I went to bed, under their music I could hear something else not so far away. A guard chasing away baboons that were feasting on our dinner scraps in the open garbage pit.
And that brings us to the end of Dispatches, a program that began at the turn of this century when the CBC asked a colleague and me to create 11 episodes of a foreign affairs program. They asked for two more, then they stopped asking, and Dispatches kept going for nearly 500 more. Early on, I'd ask our contributors to write like drunken poets, to experiment, leave in the stuff conventional news leaves out, the personal stuff, the questions. Let the listener hear you thinking out loud. When we got it right, a colleague says it reminded her of the beat poet Jack Kerouac when he wrote, "The only people for me are the mad ones, the ones who are mad to live, mad to talk, mad to be saved, desirous of everything at the same time, the ones who never yawn or say a commonplace thing, but burn, burn, burn like fabulous yellow Roman candles exploding like spiders across the stars." Which is how I found myself in the castle of a Druze warlord with flintlocks on the wall, singing on a mountain road with a bunch of inebriated Basque nationalists, in the middle of a racial standoff in Hot Coffee, Mississippi, and in a prison in South Lebanon so recently abandoned the laundry was still wet, and in this chair, talking to you. When we got it right, our stories had a beginning, a middle, and an end, and 12 seasons on, so does this program. Thank you for listening down the years, for writing, for being constant. It's been an honor.
For Dispatches, this is Charles Maines on the island of Alkhon, Lake Baikal, Russia.
For Dispatches, I'm Naheed Mustafa in Peshawar, Pakistan.
For Dispatches, I'm Neil McDonald in Tuscany.
For Dispatches, I'm David Common in Kabul, Afghanistan.
For Dispatches, I'm Alexa Dvorsen in Berlin.
For Dispatches, I'm Michael Colton in Washington.
For Dispatches, this is Yolande Nell in Algiers.
For Dispatches, this is Danny Wood in Madrid.
I'm John Baxter in Monaco Zoe, Ivory Coast.
I'm Sam Lukoya in Lagos.
I'm Hannah Eklund in Ulaanbaatar.
I'm Fez Jamil in a food court at the DLF Promenade Mall in New Delhi, and that's the view from here.
I'm Stephen Puddycombe in Herat in western Afghanistan.
This is Anjali Nair in the mountains of Bhutan.
For Dispatches, I'm Dave Kattenberg in Ejere, central Ethiopia.
For Dispatches, I'm Hadil Al-Shalchi in Cairo.
I'm Dennis Porter, and that's the view from here outside Sappho Islands Bar in Kampala.
For Dispatches, I'm Mike Hornbrook in Jerusalem.
For Dispatches, I'm Saroja Coelho in Borodyanka, Ukraine.
For Dispatches, this is Ruxandra Guiri in La Paz, Bolivia.
I'm Megan Williams, and that's the view from here on the Italian island of Lampedusa.
In Quetta, I'm David McLaughlin for Dispatches.
And that is our final podcast. Many of our past programs will still be available for the next year and a half at cbc.ca/dispatches. A reminder, this program is the work of producers Donna Dingwall, Allison Maceman, and Steve McNally, with thanks to Michael Finley and Thomas Rose. Our technical producers are Victor Johnston, Tim Lorimer, and Nima Shams. The senior producer is Alan Gattell. I'm Rick McInnes-Ray. You have just heard Dispatches. Goodbye.
Looking for more CBC podcasts? Go to cbc.ca/podcasting.